5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Wisconsin has one of the worst entrepreneurial rates in the country. We'll hear about efforts to change that.
First, our next guest says there are lots of high-achieving kids trapped in circumstances beyond their control. What they need most, she says, is not race-based affirmative action, but fair systems of opportunity in a college admissions process that doesn't exclude them. Her solution, place-based affirmative action that looks at the geography of poverty, violent crime, and underperforming schools as a true measure of need. Our guest is Cheryl Casson. She joins us. She's a professor of law at Georgetown University. She's the author of several books, including Place, Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. Cheryl, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Cheryl, to start off, what's wrong with race-based affirmative action as it's practiced today?
Well, it's a rather blunt instrument. In elite higher education, where affirmative action most matters, you can look out in a classroom and see optical diversity, different skin colors, but often if you look at the background of the kids, there's not that much difference. Most of the kids are very advantaged. And a lot of the kids who benefit from race-based affirmative action, in addition to not being advantaged, are not from the United States. And don't come out of this history, our unfortunate history of Jim Crow and racial segregation, and don't suffer the current disadvantage of segregation. And meanwhile, using race in admissions causes a lot of resentment. People of color are not the only people who are struggling in American society. So I prefer using place and other reforms that have the possibility of encouraging rather than discouraging cross-racial alliances for fairness and access to opportunity for everyone.
So how would this work? Let's break it down. If we transition then from race-based affirmative action to race-neutral ways to address those same inequalities, what would that look like?
Well, I'm arguing that the admission process should be scrubbed of any practices that currently reinforce advantage. So two things. I would say you need a holistic admissions process that allows strivers to identify the structural barriers they've had to overcome. If they come from a place that has, say, 20% or more of the people are impoverished, either their neighborhood or their school, that's something that should be taken into account, because by definition, you're probably in an under-resourced school, and you could be the valedictorian of your school, but you're competing with kids who may have 20 AP classes available to them. So place should get the kind of consideration that's currently assigned to race. I also say low family wealth should be a consideration, because that's a considerable disadvantage. But also, there are other reforms that can introduce more fairness into the process. SAT scores should be optional or not used at all. Financial aid should return to being based solely on need, not so-called merit. Legacy preferences should be scrapped. And the admissions process should screen for those factors that research shows truly predict success. Cumulative high school GPA is the number one predictor of success in college. And the second strongest predictor is grit, the willingness of the student to do the work. And there are ways to screen for that in the admissions process.
What kind of kids do you think would get included in this place-based approach that aren't getting included right now?
Well, currently, only 42% of all Americans live in a middle-class neighborhood. And so high-achieving kids that are not in a middle-class neighborhood, and that's down, Frank, that's down, by the way, from 65% in 1970. So kids who are in lower opportunity neighborhoods but are high-achieving would benefit. Now, Yes, this would disproportionately benefit African-American and Latino students because they disproportionately live in low-opportunity settings. But any high-achieving kid from a low-opportunity setting deserves for that to be a part of the consideration regardless of their race.
So to look at this from, you know, a critical point of view, why do you think we should be looking at race-neutral policies when part of the goal is to address racial inequities?
Well, currently there are 8 states in the United States that have banned race-based affirmative action. And the Supreme Court, in a recent case, the Schutte case from Michigan, has said that it's okay for voters to ban race-based affirmative action if they want to. This policy is under political attack, and it's under legal attack. In the Fisher case out of Texas, the Supreme Court came up with a more difficult standard to meet if someone like Abigail Fisher challenges a race-based affirmative action program. So part of the reason I'm recommending race-neutral reforms is because affirmative action's on life support, and if there are ways to get very close to the numbers you might get with race without using it, and you can avoid a lawsuit potentially, and you can also avoid racial resentment. So, you know, I think it's better to face the reality that this race-based affirmative action is dwindling and come up with a logical replacement that promotes fairness and access and more social cohesion.
And so let's talk a little bit more about the legal standing. So in April, the Supreme Court upheld a Michigan law banning affirmative action in college admission. As you said, it's on life support, and it seems to be struggling nationwide. What do you think is at stake, if nothing else, to address the opportunity gap takes its place, and maybe we keep seeing legal challenges and a leaning away legally and otherwise from affirmative action as it is now?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, are you suggesting that even if we went to place, that kind of policy would also be attacked?
No, just the way the trend now. If we don't fill that void with something else like your policy, what do you see as being at stake?
Well, currently in American society, the opportunity structure is such that only people who are already advantaged really have a shot. As I said, only 42% of Americans currently live in a middle-class neighborhood. And if you can buy your way into what I call a gold standard neighborhood, and I'm sure your listeners know automatically what kind of neighborhoods or towns I'm talking about, you automatically have access to highly selective K-12 education that sets you up very well to enter selective higher education. But if you're outside of those advantaged networks and neighborhoods, you have a much more difficult problem. And you know, what we have right now is a society where there's a lot less social mobility than we profess than we think America is supposed to be about. So I think without strategies that systemically attack the systems of exclusion in our society, we're going to get more of the same: growing inequality and a society that works only for people who already have access.
Now, you said that you think that this sort of place-based approach would address issues of white backlash and resentment, and I guess encourage different people, different groups to get along and not be used as what you call a wedge. How do you see that playing out?
Well, in the book, my final chapter, which is called Reconciliation, I hold up examples of multiracial coalitions that were bipartisan and included white Republicans as well, in which they moved a policy toward a fairer direction. And the example I lead with is the Texas 10% plan. In Texas, if you graduate in the top 10% of your high school, you're automatically guaranteed access to a University of Texas college or campus. And that policy was the result of a coalition of strange bedfellows, white rural Republicans, blacks and Latinos, whose representatives in the state legislature, whose kids were not getting into the flagship university. And that policy, which has been in place for more than a decade, has been enormously successful at raising the college-going behavior of students in low-opportunity places. And although it's been attacked, and you know, people who live in advantaged jurisdictions have tried to get it repealed, this coalition of strange bedfellows has held together. They may not agree on other issues, but they've held together and protected that policy from being repealed. And that's an example of the saner, more functional politics I'm advocating for. You know, we're in a really bad place in American society. And I know Wisconsin, which has gone through, you know, some pretty bruising political battles. You know, my argument is that unless and until progressives who care about diversity begin to be overt and in seeking reconciliation between struggling whites and people of color and pursue policies that are grounded in the notion of a common good, I think we're just going to get more of the same, a divisive kind of politics and a society that only works for the advantaged.
We're talking about our guest proposal to transition from race-based affirmative action to a place-based plan instead, geared toward helping students who are dealing with poverty, with violent crime, and underperforming schools in their neighborhoods. Cheryl Cashin stays with us. Her new book is called Race, Not Place, A New Vision of Opportunity in America.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think about moving away from race towards place when it comes to affirmative action in higher education? Do you think this would help address questions of fairness in college admissions and bring more talented students to the table, to universities who might not be able to get there just based on where they grew up, where they went to school? Or do you think schools should continue to try to use race as a basis for affirmative action to the extent they're allowed to do that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about our guest proposal to move from race-based affirmative action to one that's based on place, one that she thinks is a fairer version of addressing problems of opportunity, lack of opportunity, access to education. Cheryl Cashin stays with us. Her new book is called Race, Not Place, A New Vision of Opportunity in America.
And we want to hear what you think of the idea, giving a boost in college admissions to maybe low-income areas in big cities, in rural areas, places that maybe don't have the school funding, maybe that don't have a safe place for students to go and learn. Do you think they should get a boost when they submit their college application? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And Cheryl, before we went to the news, you were talking about this race-neutral approach addressing the economic reality of working-class whites and being a move toward reconciliation. How do you think that would work with this plan? Would, for instance, underprivileged Caucasians be included in place-based affirmative action?
Absolutely. What I'm saying is that a high-achieving student from any situation, regardless of race, and where they're facing isolation or in an under-resourced school or a high-poverty neighborhood, should get special consideration. In addition to, you know, part of the reason why less than half of Americans live in middle-class neighborhoods today is that the affluent and the highly educated increasingly live in their own neighborhoods. And, we have a society which is premised, unfortunately, on what I call opportunity hoarding. Once a jurisdiction gets identified as very good and desirable, often we get more overinvestment in those areas and underinvestment elsewhere. And In the elsewhere places, you tend to have fewer experienced teachers, less resources, and poverty is growing fastest in suburbs. You know, a lot of white people are increasingly finding themselves in under-resourced, rapidly impoverishing places. So, yeah, I've offered this proposal not as I'm not saying it should be a substitute for race in the sense of I'm trying to be a direct proxy for race. I really mean it when I say that it's not fair to treat a person, whatever their race is, to treat a person who comes from a low opportunity school as if they're on a level playing field with people who are in super advantaged schools that have 20 AP courses.
Now, you talk about Rice University as being an example of a university that's really committed to getting students in the gates of their university that are truly diverse from different socioeconomic backgrounds as well as race. How has that worked there, and what is the lesson?
Well, I could speak more specifically to Amherst. I cite Rice as an example because Rice was founded with a charter that specifically said this school was only for white people, and it's just ironic that today white Americans are a minority at Rice. And I was saying Rice is kind of the future. We're having rapid demographic change, but universities have to, if they want socioeconomic diversity and racial diversity, they have to undertake direct efforts to achieve that. And I featured Amherst. One of the things that Amherst does is they find students from overlooked places by working with a partner called QuestBridge. In addition to changing the factors that universities look to into evaluating students, they should work with organizations like the Posse Foundation and QuestBridge and others that are very good at screening for and finding high-achieving students from low-opportunity places that can do the work. And when Amherst did that, when they went deep into the well of low-income, high-achieving students, the racial and economic complexion of their class changed. And almost a quarter of students at Amherst, a very, very selective school, are low income.
We were talking about the move. You said, I think your phrase was on life support as far as race-based affirmative action right mm-hmm. now. Why mm-hmm. do you think that is? Why is it going out of favor now at this point in history?
Well, Ward Connerly kick-started a movement against race-based affirmative action in the 1990s, and Republican legislators have picked up that movement. In the last few years, we've had a couple of states pass bans based on race. And also, there are organizations out there that actively recruit plaintiffs to sue and bring reverse discrimination claims, like Abigail Fisher from Texas. And this comes from a place of, for the Abigail Fishers of the world, people who are white who can't benefit from race-based affirmative action, they don't like it. I mean, it doesn't seem fair to them, and so there's quite a bit of resentment out there. And I talk about in the first chapter of my book the fact of it's uncomfortable to talk about, but it's true. In post-civil rights America, many whites feel that the gains of the civil rights movement have come at their expense, and there's a lot of anger and resentment about not getting ahead, and a lot of that anger and resentment is the reason why the policy is eroding. But meanwhile, interestingly, in polls, most people support the idea of giving a leg up to someone who works hard and is high achieving based on the disadvantages they've had to overcome, whereas most people in opinion polls do not support considering someone's race in as a factor in admissions. And I think it's worth putting out there, your listeners may not know this, I'm African American, and I have two African American boys, and I say in a letter to them at the end of the book, I've written a book that undermines the ability that you will benefit from race-based affirmative action or even legacy preferences. But, you know, there's a larger issue here at stake, one of fairness and creating a saner, multiracial politics in which people of all colors who struggle coalesce around policies that expand opportunity for everyone.
Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Cheryl Cashin, a professor of law at Georgetown University. She's the author of several books, including the recent Place Not Race, A New Vision of Opportunity in America. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at a conservationist who spent his boyhood in Wisconsin and was inspired by the nature around him. That's in today's Wisconsin Legends segment.
First, when you think of startups and entrepreneurs, you might think of places on the coast like San Francisco or New York, and that may be for a good reason. A recent report from the Kauffman Foundation found the Midwest has the lowest rate of entrepreneurial activity of any region in the country, with the West Coast having the highest.
And in that report, Wisconsin ranks particularly poorly at 45th in the nation. Despite these low numbers, Wisconsin entrepreneurs are hopeful, and according to WisBusiness.com, some venture capitalists think the Midwest is ripe for a technology boom.
In pursuit of that boom, entrepreneurs from across the state met in Madison to share their stories and aspirations at the 2014 Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference this week. It ended yesterday. Now Tom Still joins us to tell us how it went. He's president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Well, does the Wisconsin entrepreneur have a typical profile?
Wisconsin entrepreneurs in many ways look like entrepreneurs elsewhere. There are different types. There are the classic mom-and-pop businesses. There are folks who start lifestyle businesses. I think some people who start businesses around social causes. And then there are those who I like to call gazelles, the really high-growth companies that are sometimes in the tech space and are often where you see a lot of the job creation overall. And our group, the Wisconsin Technology Council, tries to work across all those spectrums, but with a bit of a focus on the gazelles, those who are going to have that kind of high growth.
Well, as we mentioned, Wisconsin ranks as one of the states with the lowest rates of entrepreneurial activity in the country. I guess worrisome because you're looking for those job creators, those gazelles. What keeps people from starting businesses in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and first, a little more about those numbers. They lag by a couple of years. And they probably hit Wisconsin about the time the Great Recession was really just passing through the state, so that didn't help. And I think, too, with the entire upper Midwest, because immigration rates are a bit lower, and immigrants, especially into some of the coastal areas, well, what do? They often start businesses. And they're often the kind of the mom-and-pop variety. So the Kauffman numbers sort of capture all of that. But when it comes to high-growth entrepreneurs, I think Wisconsin is making good progress.
Well, the recession would have been reflected in all of the rates across the country. Has Wisconsin caught up to the average?
It is starting to. Our sense is, and we see this in a lot of ways, the deals that are invested in, the kinds of people who are coming to our events, the kind of investor activity that's going on, all of that adds up that at least in this sector, that high-growth sector, we're seeing progress. In 2012, for example, there were 74 companies in Wisconsin that had some kind of angel or venture capital investment. In 2013, that was up to 86. At our conference in Madison this week, a number of investors from outside Wisconsin were here, and they were very bullish on what they're seeing in the state in terms of companies in certain sectors, health information technology, medical devices, medical imaging, software, mobile apps, advanced manufacturing. Wisconsin's portfolio of high-growth companies is far more diverse today than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
So in terms of why Wisconsin dipped so low a couple of years ago, now you're saying it's rebounding, but why do you think Wisconsin took such a big dip comparative to the rest of the country?
Well, it's always been down there in terms of the it's always been somewhere in the 40s. It was the case, it's really always been the case in some ways because we're a state that's been dependent on, for a long time, larger manufacturing companies, agriculture, tourism, the big three. And I hope we can continue to enjoy great success in those sectors. But it often tends to be that you don't see a lot of spinoffs and new company creation in those sectors as well. So that combined what I described in terms of immigration and the fact that many immigrants are very industrious and they start businesses and we don't see as many as others, I think that's always been a factor in Wisconsin. It's not like we fell from the top 20 or even the top 30 into the 40s. We have more or less been there for a long time. Now, what's changed? Again, what I see is the high growth sector and the companies that are coming out that have some kind of a tech emphasis. We just completed our governor's business plan contest and a great collection of entries in that in terms of the finalists. So in that part of the entrepreneurial spectrum where we focus, I see progress.
So what has changed then? Is it just that the economy in general is taking an upturn, or are you seeing a cultural shift in the way that Wisconsin supports businesses and entrepreneurs?
Well, in terms of a cultural shift, I think there's a generation that probably didn't think as much about starting companies, about being entrepreneurial. They were more likely to work for major existing companies and perhaps for a long time. I think what we're seeing with the millennials and others is that there is more of a startup culture. Again, especially in the high growth side, where they see the advantages of starting the business and what it can do for them, you know, throughout the course of their careers. I'm amazed by how much is going on in colleges and universities and tech colleges around Wisconsin. You had to look pretty hard 10, 15 years ago to find an entrepreneurship program on pretty much any campus outside maybe Marquette and UW-Madison. Today, it's embedded in a number of campuses around the state, and we're beginning to see the results. It's sort of like professional baseball, where you've got a major leagues, but you got to have the farm system to support it. And I think Wisconsin's doing a good job of building that farm system.
Well, to take another aspect of this, the common wisdom among economic conservatives, including Governor Scott Walker, is that low taxes will support business growth. And how would you say entrepreneurs are responding to the rates of small business taxation here in Wisconsin?
Entrepreneurs, almost by definition, for the first year, two, three, whatever the life of their company, they're probably not making much money. That's a time where they are investing money and doing that to help grow the business. But during that time, they may not have a profit in a taxable sense. So for a while, taxes don't matter as much to them. They are more interested in the overall support system that they may see in any given state, where they might find the kinds of workers they need, where they might find the kind of entrepreneurial culture or climate within any given community. A lot of those factors matter as much to them as at that early stage as taxes. And because so many of their businesses can be online or really somehow internet-based, increasingly they can do that from a lot of different places in Wisconsin. So it's less about at least in those early stages about taxes and more about some of the other elements of business that, you know, add up to there's still an overall cost factor, but taxes are only a portion of that.
If you could propose one change, one policy that you think would make Wisconsin a better place to start a business, what would it be?
I think some of the things that have gotten underway are all pointed toward making capital more available. There's been some progress there, but I think we can continue to make that kind of progress. There was a $25 million state investment in what's called a fund of funds that will be matched by private dollars over time. That is a good start. I think the state should continue to look at that. I think there are a few quirks in Wisconsin law that appear to apply mainly to these young companies that you don't see in some other states that, again, are all about capital. You know, but a lot of this is not about passing a law to make things better. It's about trying to send the message that Wisconsin is a good place for entrepreneurs and that investors who are outside the state can come here and find good deals. And indeed, at our Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference this week, there were investors from a lot of different places who were very bullish on the state and what they see. You know, in the last week and a half, 2 weeks alone, there's been about $20 million invested in Wisconsin companies. That's a pretty furious pace. If that were to keep up the rest of the year, we'd have a lot better year in 2014 than there was in 2013.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. This week, entrepreneurs from around the state met in Madison for the 2014 Wisconsin Entrepreneurs Conference.
When we think of famous environmentalists and conservationists that have called Wisconsin home, Aldo Leopold, Gaylord Nelson are a couple of the names that immediately spring to mind. Our next guest says we should think about adding another name to that list, Sigurd Olson.
Well, he was born in Chicago and did a lot of his work in Minnesota. He spent his early years growing up in northern Wisconsin, where he cultivated his love for nature and was inspired to spend his life fighting for it.
Today in Wisconsin Legends, we look at the legacy of Sigurd Olson. Here to help us do that is Kristen Eggerling. She's the author of Breath of Wilderness, The Life of Sigurd Olson. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, sometimes when you read about somebody famous, there's no direct line from their childhood to what they were famous for. In this case, there really is. This was a young kid who was happy outside and wasn't happy unless he was outside.
That's right. He spent as much time as he could outside. He couldn't stand being indoors in school, in church. He wanted to be outdoors.
And he was up in the Prentice area, I think you write, in northern Wisconsin. What was it that he loved about being outside in northern Wisconsin?
Well, he loved to go out into the woods and hunt and just take it all in. He loved all the animals and everything about it.
And sometimes he maybe got a little too close. One of his life lessons was never trust a moose, no matter where you find it. How did he come by that bit of wisdom?
Well, that was a little later on, and he'd always wanted to ride a moose. And so he got this idea that if he could jump on this moose, and he did, obviously the moose was not very happy. He was lucky to escape serious injury.
And now a lot of people grow up loving to be outside. What was it about Sigurd Olson that led him to not just love nature, but make the transition to devoting his life to conservation and protecting the wilderness he loved?
Sig felt a spiritual connection with the outdoors. It fed his soul, and it was his passion and his purpose in life. And once he always loved being outdoors, but then when he saw the outdoors being threatened, he knew that his role was to stand up and do what he could to protect it.
And again, early on, he, when faced with a choice between nature and something else, he chose nature. I think that led to him being kicked off of his high school football team. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, that's a good story about him. It was at Northland College, And he played on the football team there, and he was one of the best players on the team. But he had an opportunity. The weather was just right for bluebills, and he went out hunting, spent the weekend hunting, and skipped the most important game of the year. They lost the game, and the coach kicked him off the team and told him, never play football again.
Wow. And he, through his life, he talked about wilderness and he talked about nature to anyone who would listen. And sometimes even people in his family thought, maybe Sig, a little break from the wilderness. Sometimes he just talked about nothing else.
Yeah. And Sig's son, Bob, who I've gotten to know, he still lives in Wisconsin. And he says it got to be too much at times. He just wouldn't talk about anything else.
Now, he did a lot of things. Wilderness guide, writer. Let's talk about some of his first legal battles, his efforts to preserve parts of nature. What was his first big fight?
The first big fight was in 1923. It was called A Road to Every Lake. The Chamber of Commerce and some business interests wanted to build a road to every lake in the wilderness, which would have made it not the wilderness anymore. It would have destroyed it. The next one was a power plant with dams that was being proposed, and it would have flooded all the islands in the wilderness and much of the lands. And then the next one was an airplane traffic ban. After World War II, pilots came back from the war, and they started flying in people into resorts that you could only get to by plane. And it just ruined the outdoors. On one canoe trip, Sig counted a plane every 8 minutes for 6 straight hours.
Now, thinking about the natural environment this way, it's pretty common, a pretty big environmental movement now. But in Sig's time, when he was starting this, was he an oddity? Was he a rare sort of person?
Yeah, I think he was. You know, the first fight when the Road to Every Lake was proposed, he thought, you know, how am I going to fight this? But he had guided some well-known people, and so he called them, and they said, yeah, they would lend their support. And so they helped teach him how to stand up for the wilderness. But it's not like his neighbors were doing that. He was somewhat of an oddity.
One of his biggest legacies came after he moved from Wisconsin next door to Minnesota, up the northern part of the state. What wildlife area there did he help bring into reality?
Well, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. We very much can thank Sig for that wilderness area today. It would not be there, I don't think, if it wasn't for him.
And he was not, he was part of a wider effort, but he was one of the few conservationists actually living in the affected area. Was he popular with his neighbors all the time for his efforts to protect that?
He was not popular with his neighbors. They saw him as an enemy, as a traitor, because they couldn't believe that he was on the other side. People moved across the street when they met him. They didn't serve him in the grocery store. They would move to another pew at church. They didn't want anything to do with him.
The idea being that his efforts to protect nature would stop logging and other jobs.
That's right. And allowing them to enjoy the wilderness. They wanted to be able to snowmobile. They wanted to be able to take their motorized boats anywhere they could. And they saw those things being threatened by his acts.
And then at the federal level, he was a big part of working on the Wilderness Act of 1964. What part did he play in passing that?
Well, he helped craft the Wilderness Act, and he worked a lot. He worked with Minnesota legislation, but he worked on the national level for that and worked very hard to get that passed.
And how did he inspire maybe the next generation of conservationists? Do people look to him as a mentor, as a guiding light?
I think they really do. People who had a personal connection obviously did. He had a pen pal relationship with a young girl. She was 12 years old, and it inspired her to stay active in the environment. He had a way of connecting with people on such an emotional and personal level. And anyone who wrote to him, he wrote them back and established long-term relationships. And that was a way of really having a following. And he continues to have a following today.
You talked, as you mentioned, to family members, people who knew or corresponded with him. Did you get a sense of what he was like as a person?
He had a good sense of humor, very warm, a character. Unfortunately, I never got to meet him, but I really wish I had, because he sounds like just a great guy. Anyone who's met him has very good things to say about him.
And maybe everybody, anyone who paddles up there in Minnesota will think about him now after this book.
That's right. It, you know, people, when he was alive and he was living in Ely, people who would go to the Boundary Waters, they made a point of stopping at his house to meet him before they went into the Boundary Waters or when they got back. And Sig and Elizabeth always invited folks in and served them coffee and cookies and got to know them.
All right, Kristen, thank you so much for being here and sharing his story with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was writer Kristen Eggerling. We've been talking about her new book, Breath of Wilderness, The Life of Sigurd Olsen, in this edition of Wisconsin Legends.